Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome to the Heart of Healthcare podcast. I'm Hallie Tecco.
And I'm Steve Krause. And every Monday, we bring you the latest in healthcare innovation as we sit down with entrepreneurs and industry experts.
So buckle up and join us as we figure out how to improve healthcare for all. Hello, listeners, and welcome back. I'm Hallie Tecco, and today I am talking with Dr. Toyin Ajayi, co-founder and CEO of CityBlock Health. CityBlock is the first value-based, comprehensive healthcare provider and technology platform that serves low-income Medicaid populations with complex needs. Toyin is a board-certified family physician and continues to practice primary care and hospital medicine. And in full disclosure to the listeners, I'm a proud investor in both CityBlock Health and a small fund that Toyin helps run. Toyin, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Hallie. It's great to be with you.
I think most of our listeners know this, but just in case we have folks who are new to healthcare, Medicare is a federal health insurance for anyone 65 and older, and some people under 65 with certain disabilities. Medicaid is a joint federal and state program that gives health coverage to people with limited income and resources. And then dual eligible beneficiaries are people who receive both Medicare and Medicaid benefits. Tell me about how you came to start serving this group and what serving this group is like.
Right. So dual eligible beneficiaries, as you described, are individuals who qualify for both Medicare and Medicaid. And what that means is that they are both living below the federal poverty line or around about there, depending on where their state determines eligibility for Medicaid. And they're a person with a disability, or they're a senior who's living in and around poverty. And so these are folks, no surprise, that often represent the most vulnerable people in our healthcare system. These are folks who often live with multiple chronic physical health conditions, with mental health conditions, and who also are living with the sequelae of poverty, which includes difficulty accessing transportation to get to their doctor's appointments, perhaps insufficient food resources to live a healthy and nutritious life, housing challenges, you name it. These are folks who in the healthcare system typically constitute a small proportion. So there's about 11 million dually eligible people in the United States today, but a disproportionately large part of the spend in our healthcare system. So typically dual eligible beneficiaries represent up to 50% of the spend on the Medicaid side. So that's really significant.
Yeah.
Huge opportunity to improve outcomes and to address healthcare costs. We focus on this population because we have a passion and a commitment and a mission that's oriented around improving quality of care and outcomes for people with the most complex needs, for people who tend to be marginalized, for people who tend to be left behind by the healthcare system. Because very frequently, that combination of all of the behavioral health, physical health, and social needs that I described in a society that tends to stigmatize people who have these challenges, populations who are dually eligible are overrepresentative of communities of color. They're overrepresentative, definitionally, of people with disabilities. These are folks who don't always get the best experience when they access the healthcare system. And so they're disadvantaged in multiple ways. And we felt it was really important and compelling and urgent to build a business that is focused specifically on this population, on taking the best possible technology, resources, care models, and focusing them on people who need it the most, and doing health equity work in a sustainable and scalable business context.
And for those folks that are dual eligible, are they receiving two separate health plans, or is it one health plan that they receive that is paid for by both Medicare and Medicaid?
Oh, like everything in healthcare, the answer is it's complicated and it depends. So most dually eligible people to this day still receive care in ways that we would call, you know, not integrated and pretty fragmented. So it's exactly as you said, the sort of the former. Many folks are getting care from two different plans, or from the federal government directly if they're fee-for-service Medicare, so they're not enrolled in a Medicare Advantage health plan to administer that Medicare benefit via a third party. They're directly served by Medicaid, where claims for their healthcare needs are paid for directly by Medicare, by the federal government. But there are, and this is the exciting part, there are increasingly opportunities to integrate these two products into a single plan. And in so doing, we get to create alignment for the member, for the beneficiary. We get to create a streamlined experience. We get to create investment opportunities to fund parts of healthcare like primary care and outpatient mental health that actually meaningfully improve other parts of healthcare like inpatient stays that are paid for by the other payer. And so we're really excited about the rise of integrated products for dually eligible beneficiaries, which have been growing significantly over the last few years, and where there are meaningful policy and regulatory tailwinds to continue that growth.
From their standpoint, it's probably a lot more streamlined as well. As we know, health plans love to say, no, your other health plan is responsible for that. Mm-hmm. I know every time I go to the clinic, I have to sign a waiver saying I don't have another health plan. Everyone can like barely afford one health plan, yet alone having a second one. When you're talking about this population, I imagine many of them, English might be their second language, or they just don't have access to health information. They have low health literacy. How are you also helping them just navigate what is impossible for everyone, but maybe even more challenging for them?
I love the way you framed that. It's so true, right? Like every single one of us, no matter your level of education, how much you know about healthcare, you know, I'm a physician. I still find it hard to navigate my own healthcare and the healthcare for my loved ones and friends and family. Everyone needs help. But when you add on that extra layer of you know, maybe English is not your first language, maybe instead of, you know, one or two issues that many of us are dealing with, you've got five or six or seven. Maybe your medication list is 30 meds long and it keeps changing. It just gets more and more and more complex. And then you talk about the benefit, what you're eligible for. Every time I get a letter from my health insurer, there's sort of a dread in the pit of my stomach because you have to read through pages and pages and pages to figure out what is actually going on. What are they trying to explain to me? For people whose ability to access their health insurance benefits truly are a matter of life and death, and whose ability to access resources that they're actually entitled to can make a huge difference in their health and well-being. Many folks don't know that a number of health plans pay for food, for medically tailored meals to people's homes.
I didn't know that.
That is true. Health insurance plans can pay for supports for transportation to get you to and from your doctor's appointment. If you are dependent on those things to maintain health and well-being, we got to help you figure out how to navigate that. And that's a big part of what CityBlock does through our care teams, because we're fully incentivized to make sure that every resource available or necessary to our members to improve their health and their well-being is available to them and is accessible to them and is able to deliver the outcomes that we expect. And so it's really important to us to make sure that these are benefits, not just on paper, but that our members can actually access them and get the benefit from that enhancement of their care.
Yeah. So you use this term wraparound healthcare about to kind of describe how CityBlock integrates physical, behavioral, and social health in your value-based model. Can you just give us an example of what this looks like for a member, for a patient, especially that social health piece, because it usually is completely separate from care, health care?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one way to do this is just sort of walk you through an illustrative example. using, you know, a fictional patient, say, but we, I think we can all sort of empathize with and follow their journey. So imagine you're a person in your 50s. You've been struggling with mental health challenges for a long time, and you qualify for both Medicare and Medicaid because you have the disability status due to your mental health challenges and some of the physical conditions like diabetes and high blood pressure and chronic kidney disease that you've developed over the years. And your base case, your baseline experience is that you see a doctor in your community, a primary care doctor. You're assigned to their panel. They have a panel of about, say, 3,000 patients. They're located not too far from you, but it would require you to take a bus to get there, or if you have private transportation to get there. And you're trying to get healthy. Say you also are struggling with marginal housing, which means you're not quite homeless, but you often don't have a really clear and secure idea where you're going to sleep the next few nights. So you're spending time couch surfing. Maybe you were sleeping in your car. Maybe you're you have a short-term lease. Maybe sometimes you have a little bit of extra money from your disability check, and you can pay for a hotel for a few nights. But it's not a consistent or particularly safe place to be every day. And so you wake up one day and your legs are swollen and you're having trouble breathing and you're feeling more anxious than usual. You call your doctor and they tell you that the next appointment is four weeks away, which is not atypical for these busy primary care practices. What do you do? Your only choice in that instance is to go to the hospital. And for many folks in these types of situations, the emergency room is that one place that you can be guaranteed to get seen and to be cared for in a way that at least makes you feel like your needs have been heard for that moment. So you go to the emergency room, you wait a really long time because that's the case in many of these communities in which we serve, is that the ERs are overwhelmed, the wait times are long. You're seen by a doctor and they diagnose you with new onset heart failure and they prescribe a couple new medications and ask you to follow up with your primary care doctor. You go back home. And again, you wait. This time, maybe they get to see you a little bit sooner. Now you have a new medication to get to. You've got to get to the pharmacy to go pick that medication up. Maybe there's a problem with a prior authorization. We know what this feels like, right? It feels messy and really precarious. And the idea that this person is going to, from that episodic acute care visit, suddenly get all the things that they need solved for, unaided, it's pretty ludicrous when you think through what people are working through. And when we sort of embody and remember our own lived experiences. And so what we do at CityBlock is say, first thing, we're going to go find this person. We know that their phone may be periodically on and periodically not. They may not have a lot of data that they can afford to go online and navigate resources. We're going to proactively go find this person. And we're going to ask how they're feeling before they even need to tell us that they have an acute issue that's bothering them. We do that with our community health partners. These are folks we hire from the communities we serve. It's a really important role at CityBlock on the care team. We seek and we hire people who have often like real lived experience of navigating resources in their communities, who are empathetic and tenacious. And they go and find this patient and they ask, how are you doing? Is there anything we can help you with? This person might not mention their swollen ankles the first visit. They may say, actually, you know what? I'm really worried because I'm hungry and I haven't eaten in 3 or 4 days. And, you know, I've run out of money to pay for my hotel. I'm not sure where I'm going to go next. Or they might say, you know what, just remembered I have a doctor's appointment tomorrow, but I don't have enough money for transportation to get there. We'll help them navigate and solve those acute issues. And then we will assess them clinically, as well as from a mental health perspective, and identify opportunities to close the gap in the care that they need. Sometimes the solution is really simple. We'll get you transportation to go see your primary care doctor. You like that person. You have a good relationship with them. We just need to get you there. And when they prescribe a new medication for your heart failure, we'll follow up with you the next day to make sure you understand the instructions for how to use it, to make sure you understand what side effects you might expect. And you know you can call us if anything comes up that's untoward, to make sure that it actually, when you went to the pharmacy, your insurance card went through and you were left with the medication that you needed. If you are feeling really unwell and are unable to leave your home, we'll come to you and do a follow-up visit, assess you with our clinical teams, ensure that everything you need is in place. If you need to go to the hospital, certainly we will facilitate that. But what we found through our model is that we're able to help people maintain independence in their homes, reduce acute utilization that's avoidable, so not have to go to the ER for something that could be seen in primary care, and improve quality and outcomes. That wraparound support works in and alongside their existing care providers, but recognizes that people need more often than their primary care doctors are able to give them in today's environment where doctors are overstressed with long, long, long days of busy caseloads and don't have the ability to do things that we can do, like go to the home and follow up in the ways that we do.
Who are these health workers? What are the qualifications for a job like this?
So this is a highly specialized role. These are folks who, to qualify to be a community health partner at CityBlock, you need to have like deep resourcefulness, problem-solving skills. You need to be a multitasker. You need to be empathetic. You need to be to embody CityBlock's values, kindness, putting members first. And then you need to be able to use our technology to be able to collaborate and coordinate with the rest of the care team. What you don't need is a clinical license. And we've been very deliberate and actually find this to be incredibly powerful for our members. The role of the community health partner is to advocate for, engage with, build relationship of trust with, and then coordinate around social care and services and clinical services. And we really look for people who don't have the clinical background because for our members, it presents a much easier and much more immediately engaging experience to connect with folks like that.
Do they have to have a college degree or some sort of advanced degree?
No.
No. And they sound to me like a really good friend or family member looking out for you. How, and it does feel so personalized. How does that actually get operationalized? And how do you maintain the quality of that community health partner's care, especially as you scale?
Yeah, it's such a great question. And I think you're absolutely right. When we talk to our members, we get surveys back from them, when we do focus groups, when we do individual conversations, people use words that are so deeply emotional and strong, like love. They're like, I love this person. I feel loved by my community health partner. I feel cared for. I trust this person so deeply. They're like another family member. I mean, it's really, really profound. And so you're right, sort of picking up on that deeply personal, deeply trust-based relationship. And that's been a big, I think a big unlock for us. We knew going into building this business that earning the trust and maintaining the trust of our members was going to be the key to the success of our business. Mm-hmm. Because if you don't trust, if you don't have trust with those, with these individuals, they won't tell us what they need. And they certainly won't allow us to accompany them on their care journey. Any recommendations we make are rooted in the idea that they trust us enough to listen, to try to do things differently, to engage with seeing doctors and nurses. And so this is a really, really critical nuance that you picked up on. What we found is that the way to scale this is via a number of really important core principles in the way that we build. First is the bar for hiring remains really high. We hire our community health partners, as I said, from the communities we serve, and we hold them to an incredibly high bar to demonstrate all of the attributes, behaviors, experiences, and skills that we know are important. That's thing number one. Mm-hmm. Second is we equip and train our teams to follow through on what we say we're going to do. The best way to earn trust is to do what you say and say what you mean and to treat people with dignity and respect. And that includes the right to full information and to real accurate expectation setting. And so we work really hard to build systems and processes that allow us to follow through on our promises and our commitments to our members. When we say we're going to follow up, we need to follow up, and it can't slip through the cracks. When we say we're going to coordinate a referral, we coordinate that referral and it cannot slip through the cracks. Those are really, really important capabilities that underpin this individualized trust-based approach. And then finally, we continue to listen to our members. We do a lot of work designing our care journey from the perspective of our member journey and getting feedback from our member advisory group, from our care teams, live and work in the closest proximity to our members. The design features for any new innovation, any new care pathway, any new process include a moment to stop and get input and feedback from the members whom we serve. And I think that's been really important as well.
We'll be right back after the break.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Last year, for the first time, more than half of Medicare beneficiaries enrolled in Medicare Advantage. And some people are not happy about the privatization of Medicare, including health insurance whistleblower Wendell Potter, who we had on the show last year. How do you defend Medicare Advantage to folks like this?
Yeah, I think this is not a this is a really interesting and important debate and discussion. And I think folks don't always clearly understand kind of what we're debating. So I just want to lay out a little bit,
Great. Of
my perspective on this. Medicare Advantage is a federal program that was established to provide health insurance coverage for seniors, as you said, and for other younger folks with disabilities and other qualifying diagnoses like end-stage kidney disease on dialysis. It's a really important taxpayer-funded program that ensures coverage for care for populations that are vulnerable. And I think it is critical. Ensuring that folks, particularly the most vulnerable amongst us, and that extends to my beliefs around the importance of Medicaid, have access to healthcare, irrespective of their ability to pay at that time, I think is a really, really critical foundational principle that I'm so pleased that we continue to uphold in this country and expand through the expansion of Medicaid. And ideally, we will continue in that expansion process. Then the question is, well, how do you administer this? This is a massive, massive program that covers millions and millions, tens of millions of people across every state of the country, across every service you can imagine, from personal care attendant who comes into the home to support people who need help with activities of daily living, all the way to paying for cardiac catheterization when you have a heart attack in the hospital. And all of the services in between, physical therapy, occupational therapy, you think about it, you name it, Medicare covers it in some way, shape, or form. It is administratively incredibly complex and costly because the cost of care continues to go up in across the country, and it does so exceeding the rate of inflation, right? We've seen the pandemic and the year that followed, saw a massive, massive increase in the cost of care, of healthcare in the United States. And I'm not even talking about pharma and drug costs. And so we have a real challenge. How do we manage such a complex program with such a host of service providers, a varying quality capability set and services delivered? And how do we do so while not breaking the bank, essentially, while maintaining some eye towards quality and value, which in my sort of definition and our definition of value is really maintaining a quality that is acceptable and has been defined by all of us at a cost that is frankly the least that we need to pay to get the quality and the outcomes that we want. That's a really, really difficult thing to do. And it's very hard for a government to do this at scale. And so what those of us who are really supportive of Medicare Advantage programs are really pushing for is the ability to create two things. One, smaller pools of administrative focus that allow us to do things like select really good providers and put them in a special network, negotiate different types of rates for different services so that we can value outpatient care, value community-based care, try to shift away from unnecessary hospitalizations, create an infrastructure that allows us to stratify Medicare members. So that means look across the population and see who needs more help than others, who needs maybe a little bit less help. And how do we ensure that the folks who need more help, like care coordination, like the collaboration that I described that we would offer, a city block would offer, how do we make sure people like that get access to those care and services? That adds even more complexity to a program that the government is administrating. And frankly, what I think, and so that's one piece. And the second piece is, and actually, maybe we could use some of the competitive forces that our market dynamics put in play to create even more incentives for higher quality and for better value. What if we used market forces to push for efficiency that would be very hard for the government to do as a direct single payer in a fee-for-service construct, paying for every service, every facility, every interaction as it occurs? The idea of allowing a private sector to participate in the administration of Medicare dollars through Medicare Advantage is a really interesting innovation that when it was launched was hoped to the goal was that it would improve quality and improve value. And I think the opponents of Medicare Advantage will point to recent analyses that say, well, we've actually not seen value go up yet. We certainly have seen quality improve. I think there's really good data to support that the members who are enrolled in Medicare Advantage plans have access to more services and receive better quality scores and higher outcomes. We actually then through Medicare Advantage have an objective way and a standardized way of measuring quality, which is also just an incredible thing in and of itself through the STAR program. We haven't yet seen cost improvements yet, but one would argue, and I would be in the camp, that you needed some scale first before we could really start to push that through. And so this inflection point, the point at which we are now where more than half of Medicare beneficiaries are enrolled in a Medicare Advantage plan, gives us an opportunity to say, okay, we believe that we can get higher quality. First, we can get quality measurement, transparency around quality, and higher quality in Medicare Advantage through the competitive forces and all of the different levers that these private companies have to drive quality in their network. Can we now get better cost outcomes? And this will be a really interesting opportunity. And so what I would say to the sort of the naysayers is like, now's not the time to quit. We're just halfway through. And there's a lot here to give us a lot of hope and optimism about the potential of Medicare Advantage to ultimately improve the experience, quality, and outcomes for the individual person and to push that taxpayer dollar to go further.
Are we seeing any selection bias on either traditional Medicare or Medicare Advantage? Are sicker people being drawn to one or the other?
I don't know the data on this as clearly. I think what we're seeing actually on pure Medicare Advantage, I think what we're seeing in duals, though, on the dually eligible plans is significant growth. So it's actually a very positive sign. We're seeing that sicker people who are dually eligible for Medicare and Medicaid, people with more complexity, are being enrolled quite quickly into duals and plans, to integrated plans, like duals, special needs plans, DSNPs is an example. Mm-hmm. And I think there is very, very strong evidence that those plans, again, have the potential to offer a more robust suite of services, supplemental benefits that are not included in traditional Medicare Advantage, and care coordination and integration of benefits that will be really meaningful for folks to access. So I think there's a lot of points of optimism, particularly in the growth of the dual special needs plans around the notion that that sicker and more complex beneficiaries will stand to really gain from the growth and the rise in managed care in Medicare.
So you guys are obviously value-based care provider. How does that model change the incentives for your team and just create a different ethos within the organization?
Yeah, I think it's a really, really powerful shift in the ethos within the organization and in our incentive structure. What it means to be a value-based provider means that we do not get reimbursed for every hour of care we provide, every doctor's office visit, every procedure we do, every prescription we write. Like, we don't bill on the unit of service. We get paid on a total population for improving in their medical outcomes, their cost of care, and quality. And so that ties our incentives to the ultimate outcome, which is, did we deliver higher value care to these members as measured by cost and quality? And that requires us to go find people who may not come to us willingly or voluntarily to come to a doctor's office. So as opposed to when I used to, you know, do primary care clinic, you know, I'd have 20, 25 patients scheduled for me. I would see who came in, whoever came in, that patient would get seen, and I would bill for those visits. The person who didn't come in, I have no incentive to go find them, to go to their house on the weekend, to call them up after the clinic's over, to check in on them, because they didn't come and they don't actually hit my bottom line. In fact, my incentive, perhaps, if I was running the clinic, would be to double or triple book those patients so that I can ensure my revenue by seeing as many people in the same amount of time. Yeah. Flip that to a city block model where we're fully incentivized, in fact, almost more incentivized to go find the people who have barriers to coming into the office, because if they, instead of coming to see me to get care for something that we could treat in the community, instead end up at the hospital, then we have failed to do the right thing, both by that patient, but also importantly by our bottom line. Yeah. Because that hospital visit, that ER visit, will cost 3, 5, 7, 10 times more than it would cost us to see that person, even in their home, to send someone to their home to provide the same level of care. We could do it at a fraction of the cost with a much better experience and a much better outcome for the member. And we're incentivized to find those opportunities to align the well-being and the benefit for the members whom we serve with the economic reality that if you can provide care in the community, you can definitionally shift spend and improve outcomes for people.
Generally, we think about caring for the poor, caring for the elderly as the work of charities. Why did the City Block team decide to structure this business as a for-profit corporation? Maybe you can kind of talk through that early decision on making this into a company instead of a charity.
Yeah, well, I think, not to be sort of flip, but the current modality of saying we're going to take care of folks with complex needs, the elderly, folks with social needs via charity, which is, as we know, it's volitional, right? Like, people give when they can give, they give what they can give, and there's no consistency or scalability associated with those types of revenue streams. And it creates a lot of heterogeneity, right? I'll give you an example. Many years ago, I took care of a patient who was very unfortunate. A young woman, a mom, was diagnosed with uterine cancer, which is a highly treatable form of cancer. But of course, if not treated, like any cancer, can progress and be devastating and lethal. And like many of my patients, this person was struggling with all of the rest of their social life. They were working a number of jobs. She was trying to juggle a bunch of things. She didn't have a lot of financial resources. It was really hard for her to take time off work and lose income to come to the doctor's appointments and follow up. And at some point in her care journey, she fell off. She fell out of care. We couldn't find her. She wasn't coming to her appointments. And I remember being so stressed and fearful for her. Yeah. And I was talking with a social worker who worked with me. And at some point she said, you know, it's too bad she didn't have breast cancer, because the Breast Cancer Center has a grant and they have community health workers, wow, and outreach workers. They probably would have found her. And I thought, this is bananas.
Yeah.
We know what needs to be done for people. We have chosen not to fund it through sustainable and scalable and equitable mechanisms. And so we're going to hope that she happens to have a kind of cancer that we happen to have a grant for, so we can go find her. It was bonkers to me.
Yeah.
And I became really, really compelled by the idea that, you know, one of the most consistent forces we have in this country, and this is really special and unique to the United States, is the private sector has the ability to make anything happen. Mm. Anything happen, right? Consistently. If I, like, Amazon doesn't care if I am Black, white, I live in Brooklyn, I live in Minnesota. If I want to order a pair of shoes and have them at my doorstep tomorrow and I'm willing to pay for it, they will give it to me. And that business will continue to, they can keep their promise to do that for me tomorrow, next week, and the week after. Why? Because they have a business that's sustainable and their incentives tied to their ability to keep their promise to me. If it's a pair of shoes I want today or a pair of headphones tomorrow, they'll get it done. And I thought, well, why aren't we applying the same rigor and diligence and resourcing towards building sustainable businesses that can fulfill their promises and commitments to people in healthcare? Why is that reserved for rich people who want a really nice experience of care in a one medical clinic, right? Who have commercial insurance? Why can't we do the same for folks who just happen to have insurance through Medicaid? And why don't we feel the same obligation to do that? And the compunction we had to build City Block is that I do not want to have to go find resources every other quarter from donors, convince them that this type of cancer is worthy in order to do what we know is right. Can we build something that allows us to take a holistic approach to care, to figure out what works for folks, and to sustain this for scale? And that was the real driver for us.
Yeah. Wow. And you now have over 1,000 what you call city folks on the team. And it is made up of a lot of women, a lot of people of color. It really, when you look at the team, it looks like the people you're trying to serve. How has that helped you deliver more culturally competent care to your members?
I think it's so critical. I think, you know, showing up for people with the care and resources and the engagement and the relationships that will stick and earn their trust requires that we often show up with people who look and sound like them and have that real lived experience. It's not competency, it's fluency in many ways when we talk about cultural awareness. There's really compelling data, particularly for people of color, that show the ways in which bias, implicit, unintentional, albeit, shows up in every aspect of people's care experiences, every single aspect. Yeah. The data is really, really stark and compelling. And so we know that we have a real ability to enhance our experience of care for our members, to earn their trust in a much more profound way by hiring people who look like them and sound like them and come from the same communities. It also allows us to draw folks into the workforce and value their work in ways that they perhaps had not been valued before, particularly our community health partners who, as you described, you know, don't have clinical licenses, don't have, you know, advanced degree requirements, and also aspire to grow their skills and their experience and their careers. And so it's a win-win across many, many, many angles for us.
I love that. And I'm so proud to be a little part of the City Block team and story. Last question, and I like to ask all my guests this. Toyin, if you could wave a magic wand and change anything in healthcare instantly, what would it be?
Ooh. Oh my goodness. I should have prepared for this question. Gosh, I have so many bugbears. So it might be like, what's my thing today?
Yes.
I've been reading a lot and spending a lot of time learning more about medical debt. And that continues to be something that just like, it hurts my heart and is mind-boggling to me. The number of folks for whom medical debt is crippling and devastating and terrifying. The fact that medical costs remain the number one reason for individual bankruptcy in this country is it's just mind-boggling. The share of the average household's take-home paycheck dollar that goes to healthcare and healthcare-related expenses is a massive barrier to access and to health-seeking behaviors. And so if I could wave my magic wand, that would be the thing.
That's a good one. And the CEO of RIP Medical Debt was on the show. It's a great episode for any listeners who are interested in how they are uniquely solving that problem. Well, Toyin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Hallie. And so wonderful to be with you. And just also, it's truly our honor to have you as a champion, an investor, a partner in this journey. So thank you so much for everything.
Thanks for listening to The Heart of Healthcare. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to support the podcast, please leave a rating and review, and don't forget to subscribe. The Heart of Healthcare is produced by Hallie Tecco and Steve Krause. The show is engineered, edited, and mixed by Kyle Moore. Visit our website, heartofhealthcarepodcast.com, for show notes and episode details.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding in your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.
These days, work is in trouble. We've outsourced most of our manufacturing to other countries. And with that, we sent away good jobs and our capability to make things. American Giant is a clothing company that's pushing back against this tide. They make all kinds of high-quality clothing and activewear, like sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more, right here in the USA. So when you buy American Giant, you create jobs in towns and cities across the country. And jobs bring pride. Purpose. They stitch people together. If all that sounds good to you, visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with promo code STAPLE20.